So it is quite common for Canadians to spend a little bit of time in the summer in a little cabin or a cottage by a lake. Interesting fact about Canada that you guys probably don't need to know, but I'll tell you anyways. There's something like over 3 million lakes in the country. So hence why we spend so much time there. And this is something that I did growing up. My grandpa had built this sort of little cabin when my mom was little. So she grew up spending time there, and so did I. And you know, my brother, my sister, and I, we absolutely loved being up there. We would basically run around barefoot for the entire summer. We would go swimming in the lake. We would take the canoe out. We would build fires, a marshmallow roast, you know, basically doing all of the things that Canadians are supposed to do. But spending time here up at that lake, my brother, my sister, and I, we made some friends up there. And we had two really good friends that lived directly across from us. So we used to spend a lot of time in the summer paddling in the canoe across the lake to visit our friends. But this one summer, my dad finally decided to give the keys to this little fishing boat to my brother, my sister, and I. It was basically like a rowing boat with a motor. And it was absolutely amazing. It was our ticket to freedom. Basically, we could take that boat anywhere around the lake. We could visit our friends in a second. It was basically like a massive upgrade on our summer. So the first day that we had the keys to this boat, my sister had taken the canoe out onto the lake, and she's you know, enjoying herself out there. And I, at the time, you know, the 14-year-old me, had this brilliant idea. And I decided that the first thing that I needed to do with this boat was to go and take it and find my sister and drive around her canoe to create some massive waves that her canoe capsizes. Brilliant idea, right? So I convinced my little brother that this is a good idea, and we jump into the boat and head off to find my sister. Now, my sister sees us coming. She can tell exactly what is about to happen. So I get that, like, older sister, like the older sister cut eye, you know, like, don't you dare do what I think you're gonna do right now. So we start circling her in the boat, and we go around once, and the waves start to get created, and her canoe starts to rock back and forth a little bit. We circle her a second time. At this point, she's starting to yell at us to stop. She's getting really angry. My brother and I are loving life. We've got sort of towels waving around our heads. We're getting into it. We circle her again. The waves start to really build up, and her canoe really starts to rock. We're thinking this is awesome. And this is the point where I can see some of that anger that my sister has turn to a bit of fear. And at this point, I'm realizing, maybe this wasn't such a good idea after all. So we circle her a few more times, and then we head back to the cottage. Now, when we get back home, we can see this little white speck sort of coming closer and closer to land. And this is my sister basically returning on the canoe. And it was basically a death sentence because we knew as soon as she got back to shore, she was going to get my parents involved and we were going to get in big trouble. And that's exactly what she did. My dad had this kind of famous line growing up, and when you heard it, you knew it was game over. And it went something like this. You know, I gave you kids a privilege and a freedom, and you abused it, so now I'm going to take it away. And that's basically what he did. He took the boat away from us. Unfortunately, he used collective punishment, so we all lost the boat for the rest of the summer, and we spent the rest of our time slowly paddling across the lake in the canoe. You know, freedom can really be used in different ways. I've been thinking a little bit about Nelson Mandela this week. This Friday marked the one-year anniversary of Mandela's death. And to many people around the world, Mandela has become a real symbol of freedom. And Mandela's take on freedom goes like this. For to be free is not merely to cast off one's chains, but to live in a way that respects and enhances the freedom of others. You know, over the past few weeks, we've been studying this book of Galatians under the theme of freedom. And tonight, as we land this series by looking at the very last chapter, the question that I want to ask you is this: what are you doing with the freedom that's been given to you? What are you free for? Now, just to quickly recap, for those of us who may not have been here for the whole series, we've been looking at the book of Galatians, which is basically a letter written by the Apostle Paul to a church that he planted in Galatia, which is modern-day Turkey. And he wrote this letter almost 2,000 years ago. And this letter shows Paul engaged in warfare. So what's he fighting for? Well, we know that he's been fighting for the Galatians' freedom, and he's taking on these false teachers. We've been calling them the Galatian agitators, who began to preach their own version of the gospel. And they were basically saying, you know, in order for the Galatians to be fully accepted by God, what they needed to do was keep the laws of Moses. And unfortunately for the males in this church, the particular law that they were fighting for was the law of circumcision. And the Galatians began to buy this teaching, and it was robbing them of life. It was robbing them of freedom. You know, this teaching was putting so much on stake. It was putting the entire gospel message at risk, and it was causing the church to not be in unity. So what you're seeing is a racially and ethnically divided churches, where you're seeing the Jewish Christians on one side who wanted to keep the laws of Moses, and you're seeing the Gentile Christians, who are the non-Jewish Christians, who couldn't keep these laws or didn't want to. So much was at stake. And so Paul is taking these false teachers straight on. I think Paul sums up his entire last argument in the very last paragraph of chapter 6. So this is where I want to start today. I'm going to be looking at this chapter in a little bit of a reverse. So if you guys have your Bibles, it's going to be on page 1172, and we'll be starting with verse 11. Dan, if we can also have the slide up there as well. Perfect. All right, so let's read it together. So this is verse 11. See what large letters I use as I write to you with my own hand. Those who want to impress people by means of the flesh are trying to compel you to be circumcised. The only reason they do this is to avoid being persecuted for the cross of Christ. Not even those who are circumcised keep the law, yet they want you to be circumcised that they may boast about your circumcision in the flesh. May I never boast except in the cross of our Lord Jesus Christ, through which the world has been crucified to me and I to the world. Neither circumcision nor uncircumcision means anything. What counts is the new creation. Peace and mercy to all who follow this rule, to the Israel of God. Now, a little bit of context here. Paul starts this last part of the letter by saying, see what large letters I use as I write to you with my own hand. Now, at the time of Paul's writing, it was really common to use a scribe. So what you would basically do is you would dictate your letter to a scribe who would write your letter down for you. But at the very end of the letter, you would pick up the pen and you would sign your name yourself. And that was to prove the authenticity of the letter. But at the end of this letter, Paul picks up the pen, and instead of just writing his name, he decides to write the entire last paragraph himself. And that's to prove the seriousness of what he's saying. So when the Galatians received this letter and they saw that Paul had handwritten this entire chunk himself, they would have realized, oh, what he's saying is really serious. And I think Paul really powerfully sums up his entire argument in verse 15. He says, neither circumcision nor uncircumcision means anything. What counts is a new creation. So in other words, circumcision and all the laws of Moses, well, they don't matter anymore. What matters is new creation, you know, the new life that's been won to us from Jesus. And you know, this new creation, or as recreation, Pete often calls it, is God healing and restoring everything to himself through the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. And this recreation continues in each of us with the Spirit-given new life that Pete James was talking about last week. So far we can see that Paul has powerfully hammered home this idea that the Galatians are free through Jesus Christ. And this same of freedom applies to us today. And so now that leads us back to our question, so what are we free for? And I want to look at the first part of chapter 6 for this. Now, just before I read that, I want to throw something out there. I think Paul, when he's writing this letter, is really angry and he's really fired up. And I think this is really reflected in his writing. And this last chapter is absolutely packed, just verse after verse, with different principles and truths for living. And I think you could do an entire talk in any one of these verses. So I'm not going to attempt to unpack every single one of these verses today. But I do think that there's a couple key themes here that really give us some insight into that question, what are we free for? So let's read that together. We'll start with verse number 1. Brothers and sisters, if someone is caught in a sin, you who live by the Spirit should restore that person gently. But watch yourselves, or you may also be tempted. Carry each other's burdens, and in this way you fulfill the law of Christ. If anyone thinks that they are something when they are not, they deceive themselves. Each one should test their own actions, then they can take pride in themselves alone, without comparing themselves to someone else. For each one should carry their own load. Nevertheless, the one who receives instruction in the word should share all good things with their instructor. Do not be deceived. God cannot be mocked. A man reaps what he sows. Whoever sows to please their flesh, from the flesh will reap destruction. Whoever sows to please the Spirit, from the Spirit will reap eternal life. Let us not become weary in doing good, for at the proper time we will reap a harvest if we do not give up. Therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all people, especially those who belong to the family of believers. Whew, see, there's a lot in there. But if we look at this part of the chapter, we can see that the first six verses here are all about how the Galatians can interact with each other. In other words, how the Galatians are living in community. Now, why would Paul, who really wants to powerfully hammer home this idea that the Galatians are free, spend six verses here talking about community? Well, I think community has a really important relationship to freedom. Now, Kath explained the biblical definition of freedom a few weeks ago, and she did so by using the principle of first mention. So that she basically went through the Bible, found the first use of the word freedom, understood its meaning and context there in order to understand its true definition. And she found that the word freedom in the Bible was first used in Genesis when Adam and Eve are naked and unashamed. So in other words, the biblical definition of freedom is when we are known and accepted in places of vulnerability. Kath went on to explain that if this is our understanding of freedom, then the biblical definition of slavery could be understood as wearing a mask, as covering up, as pretending to be something that we're not. But you know, in order to be known and accepted when you're vulnerable, well, you need people around you to do this. See, we can never be known and accepted unless we're really willing to let others see us for who we truly are. See, we can see here that this type of freedom is built for community. And you know, we know that human beings are designed for community. It's just in our DNA. In fact, a really effective form of torture is isolation. And people don't emotionally or physically thrive when they become isolated. That's why Luther's definition of sin is a life turned inwards on itself. So we can see that freedom is built to be used in community. And in these six verses, Paul is showing the Galatians what this community can look like. So he says in verse 1, "Brothers, if someone is caught in a sin, you who are spiritual should restore him gently. But watch yourself, or you may also be tempted." Now the Greek word here for restore, and I'm going to attempt to pronounce this, is katartizo. And this was a word that doctors would have used for setting a dislocated bone back in place. You know, a dislocated bone is painful because it's not in natural relationship to the rest of the body. And when one bone is out of place, well, the entire body suffers. So what's needed is restoration to give that bone back its purpose and its function. You know, there'll be some of us here tonight who are in that place right now. Something in your life has become broken and dislocated, and you're in desperate need of restoration. I think Paul is showing us that authentic community, and this community right here, should be a place where this restoration can happen. You know, I joined KXC a few years ago, and I have to admit, when I first joined, there's always one part of the service that made me kind of uncomfortable. Don't worry, Tom, it wasn't the worship. but it was right here in this space, the very end of the service, where people could come up and respond. See, I just never really been part of a church where this happened very often, so I kind of just felt awkward and out of place in it all. I would get nervous to come up and get prayed for, and I wasn't quite sure, you know, what's the right way to stand with people when you pray for them, and, you know, am I saying the right things? So like I said, I just kind of felt out of place. But you know, the more I've spent, or time I've spent at KXC, the more I've come to absolutely love this space. Because it's one of the reasons that we come to church Sunday after Sunday. You know, it's us in community with God, in community with each other, stepping out and responding to words that have been spoken into our life. You know, it's the chance for us to stand with people or speak encouragement and truth to them. And it's a place where we can really intentionally come up, open ourselves up to the Holy Spirit. It's a place where healing and restoration can happen or can begin to happen. You know, it's such an important part of community. Paul reminds the Galatians in this verse that this restoration should happen gently. See, even when sinful actions are harmful and they're scandalous, as they are, like sin always leads to destruction in our life and in the lives of people around us. The emotions of a gentle person are under control, and the will of a gentle person is devoted to loving that person back to total recovery. Paul addresses the Galatians here as brothers and sisters. So in other words, as equals, because this totally undermines any sense of pride or superiority that would allow us to look down on someone who is struggling, on someone who is in need of restoration. You know, Paul reminds the Galatians, and I think this is a message that's relevant for us today, that you know, we don't look down on people who are struggling, because this could be us the next day. So far we can see that freedom is best used in community. And we live in a community that heals and restores. See, we live in a community that's got the purpose of making all things new. And Jesus does this in our own lives through community. And Paul goes on to describe this community in verse 2. So read it with me. He says, "Carry each other's burdens, and in this way you will fulfill the law of Christ. If anyone thinks he is something when he is nothing, he deceives himself. Each one should test his own actions. Then he can take pride in himself without comparing himself to somebody else. For each should carry his own load." Now, I've got to admit, when I first read this part, it didn't quite make sense to me. Because how can we all be carrying each other's burdens when we're each carrying our own load? Doesn't quite make sense. But it begins to make a bit more sense if you look at the Greek meaning of burden and of load. The Greek word translated burden is like a heavy weight. It's like something crushing and overwhelming, something that can't be carried on its own. And you know, you can't help someone carry a burden like this unless you become close to them. Literally stepping into their shoes and putting some of your strength under the weight of that burden. And Paul is encouraging the Galatians to do that. I argue this is a message, again, that's relevant for us. You know, let's get close to each other, close enough to actually know what's going on in people's lives, so that when the heavy weights and the burdens come along, we can be there to step in beside them. The Greek word translated load is a lot different. It refers to a kind of backpack. And Tim Keller suggests that this could mean a different set of weaknesses and gifts that we all have. So a different set of opportunities and difficulties. And these are the things that we're responsible to God for, we're accountable to God for. So it's not about comparing ourselves to other people. It's about each assessing our own opportunities and our own difficulties and our own responses to them. See, Paul is highlighting that as a community, we've got a responsibility to each other, but this doesn't minimize or cancel our own integrity or accountability before God. It's like one of the classic tensions or paradoxes of community living. I like this part because I also think Paul is taking another swipe at the agitators, taking another punch. See, at the time, the laws of Moses were described as a yoke, so as a burden. And Paul is saying, you know, instead of spending all of your energy lifting the burden of law fulfillment, use your freedom from these laws and all the energy that you have, and instead use that and put it under the burdens of other people. And Paul says that this actually fulfills the law of Christ. In verse 2, he says, this is the law of love. So far we can see that freedom is best built for community. And this is a community that restores. This is a community that helps carry each other's burdens. This is the part of the process of Jesus making all things new in us. But God's vision for making things new goes way beyond just our own little community. You know, his vision is to make all things new. We get to join God in this massive story of redemption. That's why Paul says in verse 9, "Let us not become weary in doing good, for at the proper time we will reap a harvest if we do not give up. Therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all people." But I want to take a step back there. You know, often at KXC we say, you know, we want to join God in his purpose to make all things new. But do we really stop and think about what we're saying? You know, the vision to make all things new. that could mean partnering with God to do things like tackle poverty and injustice and eradicate suffering. But the world is complicated and it's extremely broken. And the more and more we do these things, the closer and closer we get to brokenness. We begin to put faces and names to problems. You know, we spend time in spaces that aren't always beautiful or even safe. How do you not get overwhelmed by it all? Paul tells us in verse 9, do not become weary of doing good, but is that even possible? You know, I think there's probably some of us here who've asked those questions or are asking them right now. I know that I definitely do. I work for a humanitarian organization, and right now, we are responding to more crises around the world than we have for a long time. And the reports that we're reading from staff on the ground in Syria, in Iraq, in Gaza, in Somalia, in DRC, and people trying to respond to the Ebola crisis are absolutely haunting. How do you not get overwhelmed by it all? No, I don't have all of the answers to these big questions, but I do think that this theme of freedom that we've been looking at this past few weeks have something to say here. Tim Keller wrote a book called Generous Justice, and in this book, he argues that we pursue justice and renewal in the world directly as a response to the grace that God has given us. So in other words, Keller sees a direct relationship between a person's grasp and understanding of God's love and grace in their lives and their heart for justice in the poor. He explains it like this: only if you see that you've been saved graciously by someone who owes you the opposite will you go out into the world looking to help absolutely anyone in need. Once we receive this ultimate radical love through Jesus, can we start to be the neighbors the Bible calls us to be? Now, I think Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and many of you guys have probably heard of him, I think he was someone that really got this. And Bonhoeffer was German. He was born in 1906, and he was born to an absolutely extraordinary family. To give you a bit of context, his father was the most famous psychiatrist in all of Germany. His mother earned a teaching degree sort of long before it was acceptable for women to do so. And his older brother, Carl, at the age of 23, was involved in splitting the atom with Einstein. Quite a brilliant family. Bonhoeffer was equally as brilliant as his family, and so it kind of surprised them. They were sort of, you know, scientific and interested in that kind of stuff. It kind of surprised him when he went to study theology. But Bonhoeffer was brilliant, and by the age of 21, he had earned his PhD with the very highest level. Now, at this point, theology for Bonhoeffer was a bit of an intellectual exercise. So he had never really powerfully encountered the God behind all of the theology, or the God behind the text. Now, in those days, you couldn't be ordained until you were 25 years old, so Bonhoeffer's got a bit of time on his hands, and he decides to travel to America to continue his studies, and so he moves to New York. And when he's in New York, he meets a friend called Frank Fisher, and Frank is an African-American from Alabama. And Frank invites Bonhoeffer to his church in Harlem one Sunday, and so Bonhoeffer decides to go along. And what Bonhoeffer sees that Sunday absolutely staggers him. You see, this church that had an African-American congregation before the Civil Rights Movement, you know, life for those people was really hard. But he saw a group of people who weren't just going through the motions of faith. You know, their faith was real and personal, and they were deeply involved in each other's lives. They're caring for each other, and they were involved in the community in Harlem around them, especially in the lives of the poor. And Bonhoeffer is so moved by this that he decides to attend this church every single Sunday. He becomes involved in the lives of the community in that church. He even starts teaching Sunday school. You know, I love this picture of this blonde German guy with glasses sitting in a church in Harlem in the 1930s and just absolutely loving life. I think it's a really impressive image. But by the time Bonhoeffer returns to Germany, something had really changed in his life. And before he left, his intellect was engaged in the Christian faith, but now his heart was too. You know, he knew that the faith that he had, it needed to lead to transformation in his life and in the world around him. And Bonhoeffer describes this explains this in his book, The Cost of Discipleship. And he says in this book, you know, we understand the grace and freedom that God has given to us. And this, you know, it costs God the life of his son. The grace that he's given to us is costly. It naturally leads to transformation in your life and in the world around you. And so for a German pastor at the time, that meant standing up for those who could not. It meant being a voice for the voiceless. And in the case of Nazi Germany, that meant standing up for the Jews. So Bonhoeffer repeatedly stood up to Hitler. He gave sermons over the radio that went directly against Hitler's ideology. And when he eventually was banned from the radio, he starts this underground seminary, and he starts to train these young pastors and leaders. Eventually, in 1943, Bonhoeffer is arrested for his involvement to help seven German Jews get smuggled out of Germany. And 2 years later, he's killed in a concentration camp at the age of 39, just 3 weeks before the end of the war. Now, I think for many people, Bonhoeffer's story is really tragic, and in some ways it is. But in other ways, it's such a beautiful story of someone whose faith transformed him in community. And he went out to use his faith to transform the complicated and messy world around him. You see, we've been given freedom. And this freedom was given to us completely as a gift by the grace of God, who loved us enough to step into our brokenness and die for us. This is what motivates us to go out into the world, to show people beyond our own community this kind of love. You know, for us in KXC, this can mean really tangible things like fighting for fair policies for the poor, protecting the environment, spending time with broken and hurting people, standing with vulnerable women and their children, or using beauty and creativity to transform. You know, as we do these things, and as we engage with the world, that we see the world as it really is, and we get close to brokenness, when we reach that place where we start to get overwhelmed by it, and we start to ask those questions, well, in a way, you know, that's okay. Because it was never about our own strength anyways. We could never do it on our own. And we can go back when we get overwhelmed to this mind-blowing grace and love that God has given to us. That's what's motivating us. And the beautiful thing about this is that when this is what's motivating us to go out into the world to make things new, we never do these things out of a sense of pride or superiority or even out of a sense of obligation. And we don't do these things to try to win or seek God's approval, but purely as a response to the grace and the freedom that's been given to us. So just before I wrap things up and pass it to Paul, I think this last chapter is an exciting way to end, because Paul has shown us that our freedom, the freedom that we've been talking about these last couple of weeks, well, it's built for community. Jesus recreates us in community, but this community that we're a part of is also meant to face outwards, to fulfill God's purpose of making all things new. This is what we're free for. There's two groups of people that I was thinking about this week as I put these thoughts together. And the first group is just for those of us in community right now who need that healing and restoration. You know, something in your life has become broken and dislocated. Or, you know, you're that person carrying that heavyweight, that burden, and it's overwhelming. And the second group of people is, I just want to leave you with the challenge to use your freedom to transform. You know, maybe for some of you, you're already doing that, but you've reached this place where you're starting to feel weary and overwhelmed by it all. And I want you to invite God into that. You know, give him that weariness and do it in the context of community. And for others here, I really want to challenge you to ask God tonight, what gifts and passions have you given me, and what can that mean in terms of transformation in King's Cross and in the world? Because that's what he's built us for.